Welcome, world. Welcome to a new episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Albert Dicady and Emmanuel Coffey. Good morning, counsel.
Counsel, good morning. How are you today?
Doing well. What about yourself?
Doing well, thanks. Having some coffee around the IP Breakfast table.
Awesome. This morning I already had some coffee, so I'm going to join you with tea today.
All right, that's fine.
Yeah, so we want to remind our audience that everything we say here today is our opinion and not the opinion of our employers. And also, we do not provide legal advice during this program. Please consult with your own attorney for anything that you'd like to follow from what you hear in this program. This morning, we have a guest who will join us, and her name is Jennifer Hayes, and who has a long experience in IP, in STEMs and IP in a whole host of information that she'll be able to tell us today. So, counsel, you know, how's the book sell going?
Well, just before I address your question, I'd like to welcome everyone from around the world and wherever they may be listening and whatever time they may be listening. I'm sure they will find this episode to be very, very informative. Well, so far, I guess, just like anything else, you have to put some action before you can get any success.
Yes. So the book is the Value of Your Ideas. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. And many, it's on Trafford website. It is on many other online vendors of books. So we do recommend that you pick up your copy. And like it says, the subtitle is Make Intellectual Property Work for You. So we do hope that it works for all of you.
And also, if I may add, please drop us a line. And the email is thevalueofyouridears@gmail.com.
Yes, yes. And of course, we are also available on Twitter. As we wait for our guests to join us, the guest was... again, Jennifer Hayes, when she's online, she'll be able to get us a little bit more detail on her journey in the IP world. During her path of her journey, we crossed paths and we work in the same law firm for about a year. And, you know, she's an amazing attorney that will be joining us,
and hopefully she'll leave the audience and us with some of her wisdom.
Well, I mean, what we try to do in this episode is obviously we're bringing different guests. Last time we brought in Bijan Tadayan, who's got a breadth of experience, including creating. He's also an entrepreneur. This time we're bringing somebody who you'll find out who's gone the whole journey as well, who's also now who's been a partner at a law firm, at a big law firm for a long time. So we're giving, so the audience should be getting a breadth of you know, the different experiences of our different guests that we bring in. Today's guest will be giving us the perspective of a partner of a law firm. That said, she actually just popped in. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well. So,
Jennifer, and welcome.
Good morning. Yeah. Thank you so very much. I'm glad to be here.
We were saying so many good things about you, and we didn't want you to hear the intro. You know, the esteemed attorney that we have with us right now, a great mind, a person who's done, you know, colleges in the STEMs and worked at the PTO, Worked at a law firm, became a partner, left, now is a principal at another law firm. We thank you for accepting our invitation today, because we do want to bring different people that have different perspective to share with our audience, which we are proud that right now we are listened to in over 50 countries. And also proud that 52% of our audience are women. So when we talk about diversity, we do it here, you know. Yeah. So Jennifer, please give us a little bit more and who is Jennifer, and how did you tell us about your journey a little bit?
Okay. So. As you said, I'm a patent attorney. I started out, I guess I'll go back to the beginning with my educational background, because that's very important to anyone who's interested in intellectual property, specifically patent law, which is the area that I primarily practice in. I got my undergrad degree at Howard University in pharmacy, and I actually worked as a pharmacist for quite a long time as I went through law school and several years after that.
I guess I should say HU.
You know.
All right.
I bleed blue. I also went to law school at Howard, and I got my JD from Howard. And as I said, I worked as a pharmacist through law school and then a few years after that. So I kind of did things a little bit backwards. A lot of people, because I went to the patent office after that, a lot of people go to the patent office and then go to law school, or, you know, vice versa. So after I got my law degree, that was kind of my entry really into patent practice, though, was going to become a patent examiner at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And although I had a pharmacy background, I was actually put into a polymer art unit. Which was, you know, it's a different kind of chemistry, if you know anything about, you know, chemistry and pharmaceutical stuff. You know, there's various disciplines within chemistry itself. So I was initially kind of concerned that maybe this wasn't going to be the best fit for me, but it actually turned out to you know, be okay. And I learned a lot and I really liked it. And that's really kind of when I got the encouragement from my my supervisor there that, you know, hey, you can do this. You know, you have a knack for it. You seem to be able to pick up on these different things. And, you know, you should really, you know, think about doing this like really forever as a career. I then did actually go into petitions attorney, a position there that started as a pilot program at the office, and that took me away from examining, but it also gave me more of an insight into the actual, you know, the rules, the policies, and those kinds of things that are, you know, help me delve into that a little more in terms of patent practice, which is also very important. Procedural things can, you know, abandon your application just as much as something, you know, technical. If you don't follow the right procedure, you can end up in a bad situation. So that was actually...
But Jennifer, if I may ask, why did you choose patent? Why did you choose that path?
Okay, so it's kind of, for me, it's a little bit different. So most people, I actually didn't really know what patent law was, even in law school. However, I had the advantage that some people don't have of having, my father had been a pharmacist, my mother was a lawyer. And my mother was the one who said to me when I was getting ready to graduate from law school, when I was going, getting ready to graduate from pharmacy school and thinking about what I wanted to do and decided to go to law school, she said, you know, you could be a patent attorney. And at the time I was like, well, what is that? She said, well, you know, I'm not 100% sure. She said, but I know that you can do it because you have a science background. And she said that it's only one of two actual, like, legitimate specialties in law. She said, you know, like, she could not do patent law because she couldn't even sit for the patent bar. She said, but I could do it because I had, the other one is admiralty law. I think that's another specific specialty area that you actually have to have some other certification beyond just being a lawyer to be able to do. So that kind of intrigued me, made me think, oh, I could do something that a lot of other people can't do. And that's kind of how I fell into patent law.
Okay.
So after PTO, you went to a law firm?
Yes. After PTO, I went to a law firm. At the time, I was, to be honest with you, it was not an easy thing to do. Despite the experience I had and the background I had, getting a lot of, you know, offers and opportunities. you know, coming from Howard University at the time, that it's not, it wasn't exactly known for its IP attorneys. Usually if you came from Howard, you know, people were looking for, you know, civil rights, the social justice type thing. So, you know, it was really not an easy transition to make. And I'll be honest, I think I may have applied at a particular firm like 5 or 6 times before I actually got a response from them.
Yeah, and I would think that was just not because you were from Howard, but also women in the field was kind of the old boys club.
Exactly.
Right?
So I had lots of things against me. I was a female. I was from Howard as a turn in terms of lawyers, and I'm also Black. So those things weren't working well for me for a very, very long time. And it just so happened that I was actually working on a master's in intellectual property at George Washington, which is not too far from Shrew Mine, which is the firm that I ended up going to. And they had a student attorney position. Even though I was an attorney and had been an attorney for 5 or 6 years by then, and I started there as a student attorney. But it allowed me to finish up my degrees, which is why I did it. But I'm not so sure that was the reason why that was what was offered to me.
Right, and also GW is also known as one of the best law schools in the DC area for IP.
Right. So after I started there, though, and I worked my way up from student attorney, you know, they were very impressed initially, and they came to me within a few months and said, you know, we really hope you want to stay, we want you to stay, and we'd like you to, you know, work as a full-time associate attorney. And, you know, of course, on your time frame. And so I was like, okay. So, you know, I think the very next, I started there in January. And I think by that incoming year of associates, I was one of the incoming associates at like August or September. So back then we had the classes and everything, and they bring in these big classes of young lawyers and, you know, somewhat train you to do the work. But because I had already had, you know, significant experience in training, it was, you know, a little bit different. So, but again, the transition was not easy. And then, even though, you know, I had some positive and favorable, direction and guidance and support, it wasn't all like that in the firm.
And, you know, I, before you came online, I said we crossed paths at Shugru as well. Where I worked as an attorney, and I remember you were at the time the only African American woman who was on track for partnership at the time.
Yeah, and I remained the only African American female patent attorney who became a partner at that firm until I left in 2018. And the year I became a partner. My other partner, Diallo, I don't know if you remember Diallo Crenshaw.
I remember, right? Diallo.
Diallo,
yes.
And I started out in the same class, and we both became partner at the same time. And he and I were the first, I believe, African-American partners that they ever had. And I believe I was the first African-American female partner. And
could you tell us a little bit about partnership? In terms of your experience, what are the requirements? How do you make it as a partner?
Okay, so
yeah, also make the distinction too of partner and equity partner.
Okay,
yes.
So making it to partner basically is, you know, you have a track, basically a performance of over, you know, 7 years or so, and pretty much the thing is that changes or has changed or probably is still changing, and maybe even changes based on who they're looking at in terms of trying to make partner, which it can be like chasing a Karen. It may not necessarily be where it was the last time you looked. However, generally, it's basically a track record of working, you know, performing at a specific level, meeting certain benchmarks in terms of the hours that you put in, the hours that you bill, as well as client contacts, and becoming more and more efficient, more and more independent, and ability to bring in work or to at least manage clients, those kinds of things, and also train, work well with your partners and work well with the new associates and train them and teach them. So it's a kind of a managerial thing that I guess you could, you would, you know, align it to outside of other places, but it's just within the law firm. So those types, same types of managerial type things you do in the law firm, but everything is kind of based on that. So then there's, when I initially started, there were what they call just basically you would, if you did your, basically did what you were supposed to do and kind of met your benchmarks and you know, be up for partnership and on track. And then they have to vote. And they, if you vote, if you were voted to become partner, then that was how it worked. Then they changed to a two-tier system where they would have equity partners and non-equity partners. So an equity partner is one who actually shares in the ownership and shares in, you know, all of the benefits of being of a law firm, and all the, you know, particularly the financial benefits is one of the biggest things that everybody wants a piece of the pie. A non-equity partner is one who does everything, has everything, but doesn't have all of the same voting rights and voting shares, and you don't get that piece of the pie. And usually that's like a mid-step before you become an equity partner. So it would be like an associate if you're on partnership track, and then you'd get to this non-equity step, and like 2 years or so, they'd be looking again to see if you have met their benchmarks to now become a full equity partner, basically meaning, do we want to share our piece of the pie with this person? So that's kind of how you have, that's kind of how they're looking at it. Whereas, you know, on the other side, you're looking at it as like your reward for, you know, kind of what you've done and clients you've worked with and or, you know, helped to build relationships with over your time at a firm.
So before, IP was a small field where, you know, the firms tend to be very small. And when you make it partner, many of them were, you know, also added to the name. Is there a distinction there now because the firms have become much bigger and, you know, so not even the equity partners are not name partners?
No, not anymore.
Why do you get to be a name partner?
To become a name partner, I think that that's kind of one of the things that has changed a lot over the years. Like you said, in the smaller firms, that was kind of a thing. But I think nowadays, most of the firms, like for instance, the Shagru actually dropped many of the names from the partners. It used to be Shagru, Mayan, McZinn, Peak, and Seas when I started there. But in terms of branding and just simplifying things and everything else, you know, they went to Shagru, and I think that most firms were doing that as well. And I think that was more of as just one of those things that it just took a turn in terms of the direction that firms were starting to go. So,
right. So, and putting a trademark on their name instead, right. Instead of the name partners.
Right. Right.
Now, Jennifer, if I may, how difficult or how easy is it to make it a partner? Are there any like billable hours requirements and things of that nature?
Well, that question comes with that whole carrot thing I was telling you about. It kind of depends on where the carrot is at the time that you're up and who they're looking at, I guess, and trying to make partner. So, you know, generally, so it can be very difficult to make a partner, or it can be, you know, somewhat like a paved road for you. It all kind of depends, I think, on what they're looking for at the time. I mean, I've seen people who didn't, you know, never, you know, maybe made non-equity but never made equity. I would be one of those. I never made equity at Shagru. And I've also seen people who, you know, jumped up, you know, 2 or 3 years ahead of time to, you know, be non-equity and then make equity. So, and that most of those times, those things were business decisions, you know, that there was a particular client that this particular person worked with, or maybe somebody was retiring and this particular person was the one who had the next, you know, was next in line, or had, you know, the business client contact with, you know, was kind of like the protege of that person retiring. And in order to keep that business within the firm, the, you know, we're going to jump this other. So there's politics involved in
in
becoming a partner. So generally, and often you're dealing with, you know, normal biases. I don't want to necessarily say, because, you know, typically they're most, you know, law firms and are male oriented, male dominated, white male dominated. I think I saw a statistic of only about 90% of equity partners are white. Only 9% are, you know, that's global, you know, it's around across the U.S. And despite the fact that women are, you know, coming out of law school, much, much higher ratios, they're still not, you know, the same ratio as in terms of partnership when it comes to that?
So I want to talk about, you know, your success. I know you're a very successful patent attorney. Difficult as it may have been to drive your success, but you were able to do it. So what could you share with our audience? What are the blocks? What are the reason why we have such big disparity in the IP world when it comes to minorities?
Okay, so the big blocks are, some of it is just natural personal bias. Like I said, we have men who tend to look to what they're used to and what they're used to dealing with, or their friends, or the people they've known and worked with or come across. And that's just I'm not saying that's an intentional thing. It's kind of an unintentional thing, I believe, to be honest with you. So you have that you're working against. In addition to the intentional things, there are some intentional things. But that's an underlying unintentional thing. In addition to the fact that you simply just don't have a lot of people who in minorities who are going through the science that they have to go through, then law school that they have to go through, there are financial barriers to getting that type of an education. And then particularly nowadays, they almost want everybody to have an advanced degree, which is at least a master's in most cases. In some cases, they want you to, particularly like on the pharmaceutical and biotech fields, they want you to have a PhD.
Right.
So that's four years of undergrad, maybe four years if you have a master's, or another 2 to 4 years for a master's, and you know it could be 5-6 more years for a PhD, and that's a financial barrier for a lot of people to pay for school that long, or be in industry and or be in academia or whatever with those types of backgrounds. So that's a big hurdle. And then law school. Coming out of law school, you know, going to law school is a whole different type.
I don't even know how much that beast is now, because when I was there, the average was $120,000 per
student. It's really kind of bad in terms of, I don't know what the prices are either myself. I think undergrad is, I have 3 children and the youngest is about to graduate now, and undergrad alone has been blowing my mind. So mm-hmm. I can imagine what the graduate schools are called, what the cost. But and also the law school itself, I think GW is one of the most expensive law schools in the U.S. So I'm still actually paying that loan, but that's another story.
Yeah, same here.
So
every time I make that check, I wonder. But I'm happy to be in the
field. I am too, and I really enjoy the field. That's the thing. I really enjoy the field, and I enjoy what I do. And I like the being able to blend, you know, the scientific background with, you know, the law. So that works for me. But it is a large undertaking. Like, for instance, if you think about it from like a 17-year-old trying to think what they want to do as a career, and you tell them, okay, well, you got to go to get your undergrad degree for 4 years, and then go to 2 or 3 years to get a master's, and then another 6 or 7 years or more to get a PhD, and then go to law school for another 3 or 4 years. No.
Yeah, it looks like it looks very
unsurmountable.
And on top of the financial burden that some of them cannot. But I think there's also another gap, is that the lack of information in our community of the field itself, and therefore I think we were talking earlier, where by the time they figure this out, it's kind of late. Like, you know, they never their track from high school wasn't in the sciences, and then they go to college, and then finally they learn about intellectual property, and they go, oh, I'm interested in that. I would like to do it, but they have such a gap. What do you think as perhaps as a solution, steps that society can take to mend that?
Generally, and one thing that has been happening in society generally is the promotion of STEM a lot earlier to our children, like middle schools. But we also have to get in there and start telling them about patent and, you know, IP law as well as a potential field. And I do that now everywhere I go. If I meet a college student, specifically in science, you know, you might just want to think about this. Nothing, I'm not telling you you've got to change your mind, but it's just something to look at, something to think about. As I said, I had the benefit of my mother telling me that, you know, it's something that I might want to look at when I began law school. But I've worked with students at Howard University's law school, in the patent, I actually was an co-adjunct doing the patent practice, patent, and with, you know, trying to teach them how to draft patent applications, clinic, and working with other, you know, working with clients who want to obtain, you know, trying to get some help with getting a patent application. And yeah, so some of them, they were in the class, but they didn't really have the technical background to be able to actually probably take the bar. So they would most likely end up looking into copyright or trademark as their, you know, but they were still, you know, because of the interest in, you know, in school, you can do some different things as opposed to what you might be able to do later. But no, we have to get to the students earlier. We have to go to our high schools, our middle schools, and let them know about these options and careers, you know, career opportunities that are scientifically driven first. And we have to also look at our, you know, HBCUs and our technical associations, like the, you know, I think there's like a Black Engineers Association. We need to do those kinds of things, and also career fairs and job, you know, job fairs. And when you do career day at school, because I know I used to do career day when my children were young, and I'd take a patent in there and show them what it was and something interesting to them. And they were really like, wow, you know, and it was really kind of cool. And then, like, I know my daughter's friends, I used to travel to Japan, and they were like, wow. And I would, you know, she had a really small class, so I would bring them back stuff from Japan. Of, you know, that was something that I was doing as a part of my job. Really.
Right. Make them interesting, you know, making a connection for them. But I agree. I think, you know, the earlier you get to them, the easier it will be to, so that they don't have a huge gap. And I also like the fact that you mentioned that even if you don't have the sciences, you can still practice trademark law, which is an IP field, and also copyright. And you could also be a litigator, although most litigators in IP that I know practices patent law also have science background.
There are some, though, like he had, but Judge Rader was not, he didn't have a science background. He was the head of the federal district court. So those, but, you know, we don't often have those kind of opportunities because, for instance, if you're going to put my resume and somebody, you know, up against his, and I don't have a patent background, a lot of times, you know, they're going to look at that and they're going to see the fact that I'm an African-American female, and, you know, with the, then that's not going to get me very far. So that's part of the difficulty, that sometimes you don't get an opportunity. That's the thing, is we have to figure out ways to give people opportunities to be able to, because once I did get, you know, into the field, like I said, they came to me and they said, you know, we want you to stay. And I stayed there and worked my way up, you know, for 18 years. So I really enjoyed what I was doing and had a good time. But there were other different barriers and things that, you know, you come across over time. And I really enjoy where I am now, where I am more, it's a smaller firm, and we are African-American owned. And I'm actually, like, developing, growing the chemical and biopharmaceutical practice, because when I got there, they were mostly electrical engineer types, computer engineers, and mechanical engineers. And they didn't really have a big chemistry practice. So
can you give us a taste of what it is to be a partner, especially where, like you said, you're developing a new practice area?
Okay, so this is now, I'm still in this transition phase myself. I've only been there, less than, I guess, a little bit over a year and a half. So it's been a rewarding thing. I really like what I'm doing, but it has been a transition in terms of trying to get used to the changes of going from a, you know, larger firm to a smaller firm. And also in terms of having to kind of build something as opposed to kind of walking into where things were already somewhat established. But basically, it's kind of still the same thing. I'm still reaching out and trying to get, you know, doing client development. A lot more opportunities, though, that come our way, come through some of our organizations that are directed towards like minority-owned firms, because there are a lot of corporations right now that are trying to find, you know, that want to have diversity in their outside counsel. So a lot of times we're doing presentations, requests, we're filling out, you know, responses to requests for proposals, where we're, you know, presenting what our firm can do and our capabilities, and, you know, trying to basically sell ourselves. So I'm doing a lot of that. over in terms of also in a lot of managerial type things in terms of making sure that when we do get something in that our attorneys are doing what they need to do and our staff is, you know, adhering to the company's rules, regulations, and policies. And but it is a different, it's definitely a different side of things.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that Jordan IP is a Black-owned law firm, and with all type of different attorneys, well-qualified attorneys that are doing the work. You have a pharmacy degree that's technically a PhD in science, and you know, many of the attorneys, and I know many of African Americans who have tremendous amount of experience in the field, but yet they have difficulty keeping a law firm or build one that can become big, because there's another gap that we haven't spoken about here, is that, you know, the work tend to not go toward African American or minority owned law firms. You know, I'm glad to hear that there's an effort out there from big companies to make some, do some diversity in whom they hire to do the work. But it's not lack of skill, it's not lack of competence that creates this gap. Is that it's just that there's these biases that you talk about that's creating that. Do you feel that? Yeah, I mean, how easy is it? Or I mean, you know, business is not easy. So I'm not gonna say, you know, anybody who should open a business should have full success in it. But giving a fair ground to play in,
yeah, a level playing field,
a level playing field,
you know, and you know how difficult you find that, you know, to find work, whether you were at a big law firm like Shugru. Or, you know, at
I will
Jordan
have
IP.
To say that I am truly blessed to be with the partners that I have now. Del Jordan is the founding partner, principal for of Jordan IP Law. He started the firm over 10 years ago, and he has such a wealth and dearth of experience and background, and basically just used his connections, you know, to kind of, you know, get started. And from there, Todd Vaughn joined with Dell, bringing in his background experience. Todd had his own firm, and after having worked in larger firms, almost all of us have all worked in larger firms at some point in time. Dell was also in-house, and he brings all that experience, you know, bringing all that experience to the table. And then when you're out, when we're out talking to the different people, and I think that they can see that we do have this experience. They know the places where we've been. They've worked, some of them have worked there as well. So they have, I think, a different level of anticipation of an expectation that they kind of have an idea of what we are used to, or what we, you know, what we have already been able to accomplish before we, you know, joined it. Jordan IP, Diallo, like I said, he was at Shugru with me, and he's the primary reason I ended up with Jordan, because my familiarity with Diallo, although I knew Del Todd as well. But Diallo joined about 2 years before I did, and he was doing so well in terms of business and, you know, a lot of things we had, problems we had at the previous firm were conflict issues. So some of the things we may have had opportunities to do, or, you know, with real, you know, real significant opportunities, you know, we might have been blocked because it was a conflict with something else that was already there. And that happens sometimes as firms get larger. You know, they're just, that's something that's hard to overcome. If a partner has a client that they've been dealing with for, you know, so many years, and this has been a mainstay for them, they're not going to, you know, and then you come up with somebody else and it's a potential conflict, then you can't do anything about that, really. And so that was something, that was another thing that we were running into. So when you can't bring in business because there's conflicts, and then, you know, they're looking at, you know, is she bringing in business or is he bringing in business? And that's not helping you in terms of whether or not you're going to the next level between equity and non-equity and equity. And at Jordan IP Law, for, you know, particularly for me, coming in with there almost being no chemical or no pharmaceutical, you know, clients, I got an open playing field. So I don't have conflict issues So I've been able to get in some big clients, and you know, we're doing the work, and they were impressed with, you know, our background and the number of attorneys that we have. We primarily have mostly very, very experienced attorneys who either came from big law firms, they may have worked in you know, industry, and the level of experience and the number of attorneys that we have allows us to be able to actually, you know, to really be able to do the work and do good work. And that's really kind of the bottom line.
That is awesome, Jennifer. Thank you for being with us today and telling us how your journey through, you know, to the IP world, starting from STEM, making a stop at the patent office, join a big law firm, now building a whole practice at another Black-owned law firm, and you guys are being successful. And thank you for coming today. We really want, we'll invite you back to see how you're doing maybe two, three years from now. And we look for people like you who are being successful in the field, so we can let our audience know that there are people successful in the field. And who, you know, we're not saying it's easy. We're not saying there isn't some kind of biases out there, but it's a rewarding field. All three of us on this episode, you know, enjoy what we do in IP, and we all work in different facets of IP right now. And thank you very much. Would you like to leave, you know, contact for our audience to contact you,
whether Twitter or LinkedIn? Sure, I am on LinkedIn. Just look me up, Jennifer M. Hayes. I believe is all that. It's my name on there. Twitter. On Twitter, but I don't do a lot of professional things on Twitter. Meaning that you know, I actually don't do a lot of anything on Twitter. I just kind of actually just watch. But also, you can reach me by email at jhayes@jordanipnaw.com. So it's just jhayes@jordanipnaw.com.
And obviously, if they ever need an attorney in the biotech field, Jennifer is the one to look for
at Jordan biotech, IP. Pharmaceutical, give me a call.
Don't be a stranger, Jennifer.
Oh, I am so glad to have been able to be here today, and thank you so much for inviting me, and I look forward to, you know, keeping in touch with you guys.
Great. Great.
So, your Twitter handle?
Mine? Oh.
No. Oh, yes. They can reach me at Coffee Law, CoffyLLC. And
you can reach me at @ADECADY on Twitter, and also at thevalueofip@gmail.com.
Great. Until we see you again, be well.
Thank you.
Take care now.